From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. It's episode 48 for Friday, the 21st of October, 2011. On the show this week...
The most effective form of airline profiling, if you want to spot a suicide bomber, is not to look at skin colour, ethnicity or religion. It's ask them what they did at university. If they studied engineering, marigolds on, basically. And
with our Wired 2011 event now over, our minds have been left throbbing like a nose punched by the fist of ideas. This week, we'll open that fist up as we walk you through some of our personal highlights from the 2 days of talks. But if you think that will get in the way of moon colonies, malaria vaccines, and indie game developers, fear not, because first we're going to punch our way through this week in Wired News. Ahoy to the hoy, I'm Nate Langson, and joining me this week is news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And of course, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Not wearing a horse-themed t-shirt today.
I am not, and I do not wear one every single day either.
What's that on your t-shirt? It's a kind of swallow?
It's a bird of some description. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Pair of swallows. Well, we're not going to dilly-dally too much because we've got a massive packed show full of, not interviews, features, talks, bits of talks,
good
highlights.
Things.
Brain food. Instead, we're going to dive right into something not necessarily cheery, but actually very, very positive. Malaria vaccines, Duncan, actually live. There's been a trial that's been very, very successful, I hear.
Yes, after 24 years of work on this particular vaccine, researchers have just rounded up the final stages of the clinical trial, and they found it to be effective at preventing malaria in 50% of children who were given the vaccine, and it's been deemed a success.
And this has been something that, as you say, has been going for about, a quarter of a century,
yeah.
This research. So this must be an amazing achievement for the people involved.
It is, and particularly the researcher named Joe Cohen, who's been there since the beginning. It's so rare that researchers get to see their work come into fruition, and hopefully he'll be there in 2015 when the product comes to market.
How does the vaccine work?
Well, the vaccine stimulates a response from the immune system that then prevents the parasite from multiplying in the liver, which is what causes all the malarial symptoms.
Yeah, malaria's come from mosquito bites, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And do we know how long this could be until it's actually out and deployed?
Well, the researcher, Joe Cohen, reckons it can be licensed and available by 2015, and that's through GlaxoSmithKline.
Who did the research, I think?
Yes, they did.
It's great news. We are going to move on, though, from medical stuff to Androids. Duncan had a massive, big, fat smile on his face last week because we got some stuff quite early. Duncan, explain,
yeah.
Plus.
I was very kindly handed the Galaxy Nexus, which is Google's latest in its kind of line of reference handsets, like the Nexus One and the Nexus S, that developers and users, if they want to, can buy to see what the next version of Android is like.
Now, I'm not too bothered about the phone itself because, I'm not. It's what's on it that interests me, which is a new version of Android.
Ice cream sandwich.
Yeah. So what's so cool? Give me four awesome reasons to care about ice cream sandwich.
Okay. Number one.
By the way, stupid name, let's be honest.
Yeah, I think they're running out of ridiculous confectionery.
Well, I mean, what other desserts are there that begin with
Why
I?
Why does it have to be a dessert?
Ice cream.
Why didn't they change?
But ice cream looks like... imagine what ice cream looks like. It looks remarkably similar to frozen yogurt, and they've already got frozen yogurt.
Who
they've
cares?
Got Froyo. Google cares. It's a branding thing.
That's dumb.
Anyway, let's carry on. Want four reasons. Here are my four reasons. Number one, ice cream sandwich is the first version of Android that will work on both tablets and on smartphones. It takes the best bits of Honeycomb, which is the tablet operating system, and Gingerbread, which is the phone operating system, and it kind of spins them into something new.
Okay, that's half a reason. Give me the other half of the reason.
I think that's a good reason as any.
I want to know what features come out of that. So,
okay,
right,
well, that's number two. That's reason number two. Reason number two is that it's been given a dramatic kind of user interface overhaul. There's quite big changes in how you interact with it, particularly in the hardware buttons are completely gone. Instead, there's going to be contextual on-screen buttons that will change depending on your task.
Okay. And how is that going to actually affect me? I mean, how does that change navigation?
Say
it's different, but
yeah,
how?
So it means that a button to pop up a menu will only appear if there's a menu to pop up, for example. And in other situations, then you can save that kind of screen space, which is important on mobile phones.
Liv, are you excited yet?
I need to have a play with it. I didn't get to have a little play around with...
That's a fancy word for no. Duncan, reason three.
So far, so not so much.
Reason three, and this is probably my favourite of all of them. Android Ice Cream Sandwich has got the ability to keep track of which apps are using data. Android has, for a long time, been able to track which apps are using battery, which is really, really handy for working out which ones are, you know, robbing you of your precious juice. But in the new version, it will track your data usage and alert you, or if you want to, it can kind of cut off your data access when your total reaches a particular level that you can set.
Okay, that's a really good feature. That's something that the iPhone should have and doesn't natively anyway.
And reason number four is I haven't actually had a chance to play with this particular thing myself, but it sounds amazing. They say that there's a facial unlocking method where you just point the front-facing camera at your face and it recognizes it's you and it will unlock the phone.
Oh, that's
what
good.
If it was my twin brother?
It would probably
work. What if it was a photo of you?
That might work.
This sounds like a hands-on test.
Yeah.
Okay, and people probably want to know, when can I get Android 4? Because Duncan's made it sound exciting.
Well, that's kind of a good question. It's going to be first available on the Samsung Galaxy Nexus, which is the reference handset that I was talking about just earlier. I'd expect that the Nexus S and possibly the Nexus One won't be too far behind that, because Google controls when those phones get updates. But as for other handsets, things like the HTC Sensation, the Desire, the Samsung Galaxy S2, things like that, that will very much depend on both the manufacturer and the operator as to when they're going to roll it out, because they'll need to kind of rewrite bits of it to, you know, suit their UIs.
So what you're saying is, don't bother waiting, hanging around for people to update. Just go and get an iPhone 4S.
Or, you know, you can just go on the internet, root your phone, get a ROM that will do it perfectly well. I'm sure those will be available far in advance of the official releases.
Well, we've got a review of the new Galaxy Nexus, which I think we had before anyone else in the world, much to our commenters' chagrin, but never mind, they're always amusing to read. If you search for Google Nexus, I'm pretty sure you'll find the review on wired.co.uk. Staying on the topic of phones though, Liv, you wrote about vibration this week.
I did indeed.
Elaborate, bitter.
Well, most people, I don't know about you guys, but when you arrive at work, you get to your desk and you take your mobile phone out of wherever it's been hiding en route and you pop it down alongside next to your keyboard, right?
Right.
Well, imagine if your phone could actually be working out what you were typing into your keyboard, including passwords. This is about picking up on very subtle vibrations, well, on the vibrations that you make by typing into your keyboard. And the clever people at Georgia Tech University have developed a program that can work out, based on the vibrations on the table of you typing on your keyboard, what you are typing, working out how far away or near the kind of vibrations are from the phone.
Okay, so it's using the accelerometer in the phone, which
yes.
is what determines sort of...
It picks up vibrations from the accelerometer. Now, the microphone can also do this, but the key difference here is, with the accelerometer, an app very rarely needs to ask your permission to give it access to the accelerometer, unlike things like the microphone, which can also do the same thing.
So what's the actual use here? Is this the next thing for Bond tech?
Potentially. I mean, they're saying it's very difficult to do. These guys are real, you know, we've got some serious computer science nerds on the case here. But you could download a seemingly innocuous app that could be, you know, My Pony or something, and it could be spying on everything you're typing into your keyboard, including your passwords.
But surely only if your password was a dictionary word, right? Because if it just knows kind of like there's something over that side of the keyboard and something near to you, then...
Yeah, that is true. It tends to... It's programmed to look for dictionary words based on sequences of letters that you type. So yes, that is the case.
So I guess it would be good at maybe working out, say, I don't know, a sentence that you're typing, but not, you know, it couldn't tell the difference between Q and W on a keyboard, for example.
No, it has to have a sequences of words that would make be dictionary words. So yeah.
Mm. Wired.co.uk podcast, bringing you the latest news in vibration technology since 2010. Let's move on. Indie games. Duncan, you surprised me about 10 minutes before we recorded the podcast saying, can we put this awesome story in, because it's awesome and a great story.
It's pretty damn awesome. This is 100 developers who have put 300 games that they've built all together into one big package called the Pirate Cart, and released it for free and also entered it into the Independent Game Festival.
All right, so two things here. What is the Independent Games Festival, for anyone who doesn't know? Why is it interesting?
Okay, it's interesting because the world of independent games is really interesting. We all know about kind of AAA titles, Call of Duty, Uncharted, things like that. But independent games right now are an incredibly vibrant source of creativity within the games industry. We've seen stuff come out of it like Minecraft, which is fascinating, Terraria, various other titles.
Angry Birds. That's independent, technically.
Yeah, I suppose it technically is. The Independent Games Festival exists to celebrate some of these ideas, but the independent games kind of community has been getting bigger and bigger, and the budgets have been getting greater and greater, thanks to the likes of Angry Birds and Minecraft and so on. And so to enter the Independent Games Festival, you have to stump up a fee of, I think it's around £90, something like that. And for a lot of developers who are just coding in their bedrooms, doing it for fun, that's still quite a lot of money. So 100 of them banded together, put 300 games in one package, and then shared out that £90 fee among all of them.
So
the judges are going to have to play all these 300 games.
So are you saying that they couldn't afford a pound each? I mean, the maximum they could afford was a pound to enter into these awards.
To be honest, I don't think the financial thing is really that big a deal. It's more just for fun. Terry Cavana, who's one of the developers who's in there, who built a game called VVVVVV, said that the Pirate Cart represents a different side of indie games, one that's much more interesting and one that's not so easily represented in the IGF.
So what are some of the games that are in this package anyway?
Well, the aforementioned Terry Cavana has contributed two games. There's a 1 minute long RPG called Heroes Adventure. There is another title called Graveyard Revolution, which is basically Dance Dance Revolution, but on burial sites, which is interesting. And then there's a game called Big Runner by a guy called Matt Ricks, which has a fat guy trying to stay fit, running around roads, avoiding birthday cakes and tanks.
I used to have a friend called Joe who used to make these crazy games on an old Windows 95 app called the Games Factory, or Click and Play.
Yeah, Click and Play.
And he made these crazy games that were things like, you know, watching paint dry and pointless violence that were just sounds like the kind of thing that now...
Yeah, this is exactly kind of what this is. There's an RPG in there made in Click and Play that has a motorcycle that has a giant penis as well. And speaking of penises, there's a game called Space Phallus, which is a shoot 'em up where huge penises fly at you in space.
And they wonder why they needed to put 300 all in one to get it in the competition.
With that level of quality.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. I think if people can go and download this game, can't
they? Yeah, it's quite a big file. It's 1.3 gigabytes. And if you go to, I think it's piratecart.com, you can pick it up. It's worth having a poke around. It's kind of very much the jungle of video games. It's not, you'll be surprised what you find, and probably disappointed in a few cases, but you'll also find some incredible things.
Well, other places you'll find incredible things includes the moon. A Russian cosmonaut has plans to set up a colony on the moon, and this colony would be inside these sort of lava caves that were discovered a few years ago to be on the moon. And the idea being that on the moon, he would be able to inflate these kind of tents-like, tents really, they're inflatable, in these tunnels in the moon, and get enough protection inside there from things like solar radiation and stuff like that to actually survive on the moon underground, Clangers, basically.
This sounds like the beginning of a sci-fi horror film.
It does, but you know what? It's not that far away. I mean, it's been estimated that we could have a lunar colony by 2030. That's less than 20 years away, and the Soup Dragon, as we know from the Clangers, has been up there waiting for us for a long time.
But beyond the novelty, why would you want to do that?
Well, I mean, the thing is, if we're going to have a colony on the moon and we can build it in such a place that naturally gives it protection from things like radiation, then anything you do to further protect from radiation is only going to be a bonus. And this just seems like a natural way to start. I mean, there's no atmosphere on the moon, for one thing, so that's a problem. So if your atmosphere is effectively a solid surface above you...
Parties are rubbish.
Parties on the moon are limited.
And I guess it's much less effort than going there and trying to kind of erect some kind of structure in the low gravity of the moon, or maybe digging into the moon's surface manually. You could just go down there, inflate a thing, and then boom, you're in.
Yeah, it's probably slightly more complicated than just blowing up a pump as you would at a festival, but the principle is the same. Yeah, I mean, you don't need the structure because the structure is the moon itself, in a sense. So obviously there are still quite a few things to get sorted out before we are going to be living in inflated subterranean moon tents.
We should probably send some robots down there first.
Yeah. Probably will.
Can plug the cheese holes.
Yeah. But you know, on that note, we're going to leave this and we're going to nosedive into Wired 2011. Except not yet, because we have an ad break first.
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the latest interactive issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
But if we can do it, it's going to be amazing. It'll be like the ancient powers of word of mouth meets the modern network world.
So last Thursday and Friday at the St. Pancras Renaissance Hotel in London, we had our very first Wired event, Wired 2011. And the idea behind Wired 2011 was kind of to make the Wired magazine, the podcast, the website into something alive, really, and
something physical. Well, yeah. I suppose the magazine's kind of physical already, but living, breathing.
Experiential.
Yeah, all of those things. We were going to have all the talks on the website over the next couple of weeks, but we really wanted to bring you something from the event before then, because you'll listen to the podcast. That means you're awesome.
You're the chosen ones.
And we've picked seven of our personal highlights from the 2 days.
So who were your highlights?
Well, I had a few, but my first is Rory Sutherland from Ogilvy, and he had some really interesting, well, interesting and entertaining opening views on something that has bugged me for a long time.
Would you believe someone actually wrote that line? Unexpected item in the bagging area, okay? Now, for those of you who are too grand to know what it means, how many people don't know what it means, have never heard that line? Few of you are too grand to do your own shopping, or indeed you're very, very early adopters of online delivery. What happens if you try and shop for yourself at Sainsbury's or Tesco, and you put accidentally, while you're actually moving things from your basket into that little weighing thing, after you've scanned it, if you put anything that you haven't scanned that weighs more than a gnat's fart on the area to the right, a voice, which they researched, and they decided after considerable market research to make it a female voice, actually says, unexpected item in the bagging area. Now, I think we can say that was probably written by a software engineer. The only possible defence was that it was written by a massive fan of the early James Bond films, who only after a considerable amount of persuasion by his boss was actually persuaded not to prefix it with a loud klaxon, and having 5 or 6 people in red overalls come running out with submachine guns into the shopping area of Sainsbury's. That's the only possible place. An early James Bond film is the only possible place you could ever have a spoken announcement that says, unexpected item in the bagging area. I mean, short of saying, you know, Hal, open the pod bay doors, it's hard to think of a less human-friendly way to actually address the problem. It does practically nothing, it explains nothing, and actually just fills you with terror.
Okay, next up, Duncan, pick a favourite.
I really liked Rachel Botsman, who was one of the very early speakers. She was second, I think, is that right?
Mm. Or third.
And she talked about kind of reputation capital, which I think is a really, really interesting concept for the future.
One of the areas that I'm looking at is the idea of reputation capital. Now, my working definition is that reputation capital is the measure or value of a person's reputation across different communities and marketplaces. This isn't your social media profile, this is something different. Because what's starting to happen is that as people transact on Zopa, as they transact on TaskRabbit, as they transact on Airbnb, they are leaving a reputation trail of how well they can and can't be trusted. So what I'm interested in is, can the different dimensions of trust, generosity, reliability, consistency, can they be tracked and aggregated? Now, this is really complicated, right? But if we can do it, it's going to be amazing. It'll be like the ancient powers of word of mouth meets the modern network world. Now, I think that reputation capital is going to become a cornerstone of the 21st century economy. I think it's going to become a currency that's more valuable and important than our credit history.
The other person who I thought was absolutely fantastic was Bjarke Ingels from Danish architecture firm BIG, who delivered an incredibly energetic presentation, kind of taking through this kind of architectural safari of all his company's concepts and constructions for the future. But there was one bit that I particularly liked.
So this leads me to sort of the last sort of realm of projects that we are currently investigating, dealing with the infrastructure of our city as a social potential. And we started looking into this when Audi commissioned us to look at the city of the future. And you can ask yourself, like, why does Audi care about cities? They make cars. Well, essentially because right now in cities, cars are seen as the main problem. They cause congestion, they cause pollution, they cause noise. But 100 years ago, the car wasn't the big problem. The big problem was horse shit. Every horse actually drops 11 kilos of horse shit per day. 11,000 horses would die every year on the streets of London, causing, you know, biohazards. There was like thousands of tons of horseshit had to be moved away, and cities were literally drowning in horseshit. And we got saved by the car, that compared to the horse, it's actually clean and safe.
Liv, your turn. Pick a favourite.
Yeah, one of my favourites was Jeff McGrath from McLaren, who talked about the sheer volume of data points that they collect every single race weekend and what they do with it to predict what's going to happen in a race.
Objective measured data drives everything that we do in the race. More than that, the data feeds into models that allow us to simulate how our car is performing in the moment and will perform in the future, and also how our competitors are performing relative to us. So we leave nothing to chance. On a single car, you'll take hundreds of streams of data. Hundreds of streams of data generating actually over a billion data points in a race weekend. And those data are fed back to a distributed team around the world. So, for example, this weekend there's a race in Korea. There will be 40 people at the track, but for those two people in the cars, there'll be 40 people in the garage, a management team up on the pit wall, and there'll be an equal body of people back here in Woking, just half an hour away from here. And what's interesting is the strategy for the race will be driven from here in the UK. So data for us is everything because it drives the strategy in real time.
Another of my favourites was Azaraskin, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, who is from Massive Health, which is a company that's trying to find ways to use technology to provide feedback mechanisms to make people healthier in their daily lives.
Our healthcare system, sort of worldwide, is repeating the same mistakes. We do the same thing and expect us to get better, and whatever we're doing now clearly is not working. So our healthcare system is, in fact, insane. One might even say clinically so. Only 22% of people don't finish their antibiotics course. So that creates all sorts of terrible super viri. And why? It's because people start to feel fine, so they think they're fine, so they just stop. And no amount of education, like most people will know what happens, has solved this problem. So is this people's fault that they don't finish it? Or is it the design of our intervention's fault? Well, I think it's obvious. It's the design of our intervention's fault because people are people are people. They'll always be people. So we have to change the way we deliver medicine and think about medicine for it to be truly effective. Another example is blood glucose. So I've been testing pretty much every day. This thing takes blood. And generally how it works is you have this thing, goes like that, that's a strip. Then you hurt yourself, ouch. Then blood comes out. So diabetics have to do this. Delicious. A couple times a day, then it counts down. And then, boom, it gives you a number. 101. What the hell does that mean? This thing determines whether you live or die, and it doesn't even tell you, and this thing is state of the art, this thing doesn't even tell you whether that number was good or not. Right? So no wonder if this is the kind of support we give people, the people that need the support the most, that people actually aren't compliant.
Alex Lasky from O-Power kind of riffed along some very similar topics, but talking about energy-saving principles and specifically using Amazon-style recommendations to kind of tailor tips for energy-saving to individual people.
Amazon sells over a million products on their website. Each of us gets an email often from them. None of those emails are a digest of the million products they sell. They're emails with recommendations specifically for us, based on what we've purchased in the past, what we look at, what other people like us have bought, and they're quite good. Now, there aren't millions of things you could do to change the way you use energy in your house, but there are hundreds, and we've already established that saving energy is far less exciting than shopping. So it's crucial to use data to drive recommendations. So here's a couple of ways in which we do this. We take the data from utilities. We combine it with temperature and humidity data on an hourly basis from thousands of weather stations. And we begin to pull out for each customer how much, where are their big opportunities to save. For this customer, they may be efficient overall, but when it comes to heating their house, on the coldest days of the year, they're using 37% more energy than their neighbors. This is where they should be focusing their attention. Online, there are all kinds of tools to help them identify these key spots. And then we lubricate the action by giving them offers to help them save. Here's for insulation.
I particularly liked Andrew Keen, who caused a bit of a stir, I think. It was a bit controversial on the day by sort of going against the flow. Andrew Keen is an author and delivered a pretty passionate talk about digital narcissism.
I went up the Acropolis a few weeks ago after David and I go to the WPP stream event, and all I found at the top were people photographing each other. That's a wonderful example of what I call digital narcissism. Social media is digital narcissism. We've invented this technology. Joanna says technology is finally catching up with human behavior. I'm not so sure if that's true. Technology is changing human behavior. Technology is changing it in a way in which we are using it to promote ourselves, from our photographs to our taste, to what we're playing on Spotify or SoundCloud. Why are we giving away so much of our information, so much of our intimate information, our reading habits, our television habits, our listening habits, our political views, so that Noreen can listen in and quantify it, so that Facebook can be valued at $80 billion, even though they're not paying us for our information? Something has gone fundamentally wrong. Even Sean Parker has come up with a term with his new startup, Airtime. We shouldn't want to eliminate loneliness. We need to remind ourselves of who we really are. Technology is not finally catching up with human behavior. Human behavior is something essential, and we can't be corrupted by the kind of narcissism and stupidity that social media is promoting.
And last on our list, we had another one that we just had to play from Rory Sutherland from Ogilvy. I'm going to give it no introduction.
The most effective form of airline profiling, if you want to spot a suicide bomber, is not to look at skin colour, ethnicity or religion. It's ask them what they did at university. If they studied engineering, marigolds on, basically. And there's a reason for this, according to Gambetta and Hertog, two sociologists, who posited that engineering creates in the brain an extraordinary discomfort with any form of ambiguity, because engineering is all about the elimination of ambiguity. As a result, they're drawn to an interpretation of religion, which is, for all its strengths or faults, is spectacularly unambiguous. Because ordinary human behavior is simply too fuzzy and weird for them to cope with, therefore they seek a system by which to live, which allows for absolutely no ambiguity or fuzziness at all.
Well, they were just some of our highlights. We're going to have every single video of all the talks in full for free on wired.co.uk, and they'll start rolling out probably by the time you're listening to this on Friday, the 21st of October. So go there, check them out, and they'll be rolling out over the next few days. But also, since we're all on the show floor, there were a lot of people just in the kind of the delegates and a lot of speakers are just wandering around in the evenings as we had a lot of kind of evening entertainment on. So Katie grabbed some of the delegates and speakers in a corner between beers, and this is what they had to say about the conference.
It's the end of day one of the Wired 2011 conference. I'm Katie Scott, and I've come up to corner some of the delegates and some of the people who spoke today to find out exactly what they thought of today's event, and also to find out which talk they found most inspirational.
I'm Ollie Barrett, and I'm a founder of the co-sponsorship agency and also Startup Britain.
Well, Ollie, it's fantastic to meet you. Would you mind summing up the conference for me in just three words?
My three words would be inspiring, connected, and enjoyable. My favourite talk was Rachel Botsman talking about collaborative consumption, because it forced, I think, all of us to ask big questions about what we use, how we use it, what the point of owning anything is. And clearly there are a lot of points of owning some things, but maybe we need to rethink that a lot. Rachel Botsman's talk was particularly inspirational for me because, as a co-founder of Make Your Mark with a Tenner, where we lend kids money to go and do something with, it gave me a new piece of inspiration about how that might be funded going forward, not from a central bank, but from other people. So a really practical insight that I think will lead to good things.
Hi, I'm Alex Hoy. Apparently I'm number 71 on the Wired 100 investor and digital marketing guy. And today, three words to describe it: the right balance between esoteric, practical, and cool. That's what I'd say. And my favorite talk was about collaborative consumption, and that's because what it does is it really harnesses the new developments in what we're doing in the web, where people can influence each other. It's not top down, it's not even bottom up. There's a hell of a lot of side to side, a lot of lateral going on, and I like that.
And do you think that that talk has any implications for the work that you do on a day-to-day basis?
Every day. People influence people. People trust one another more than they trust advertisers. A lot of what I do in both my day job and my investments are about advertising and advertising technology. And the more you can harness what people are telling each other and being part of that conversation, the more that you're going to be relevant as a brand and as a product.
So my name is Alex. I'm the founder and CEO of SoundCloud.
Can you describe the conference in three words for me?
Many great sounds.
And of the talks that you've seen today,
yeah,
which one did you find most inspirational?
I thought it was really inspiring to see two trends that I care about a lot myself be sort of highlighted a lot. And one is sort of mass customization, 3D printing, and the other one is AR, like flying drones. And both of those things are things that I think are really cool and will have an impact on the future.
So you're going to go and try and get yourself a 3D printed violin today?
I would love to. Like, God, I wish I had my own 3D printer. I could print all these like crazy like waveform images of sounds and stuff like that. If I had one, I would probably go nuts with it.
I'm talking to Sia from Digital Forming. So Sia, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
First question, please, could you sum up the conference in just three words?
Digital, physical, and everything in between.
So what was your favorite talk and why?
I really liked, to be honest, I really liked Lisa's talk. And the whole session, actually, from Chris Anderson, where we're really talking about the shift of paradigms from the creation of the internet in the last 20 years, and now how that's influencing the physical world, has creeping almost outside of the computers into our physical objects. And Lisa's talk spoke about the idea of co-creation, moving consumerism into creationism, so moving people outside of being simple consumers into interacting with their products and having some sort of ownership.
Coming back to the 3D printing side of things, and in Lisa's talk she talked about how basically the printers are going to keep on coming down in price, and it does basically open up this technology to the general public as opposed to keeping it in the hands of the few. Do you think that's something that could happen in the next couple of years?
I believe so. There are already open source 3D printers out there for under $1,000. So if you really want one, you can buy one today. Now the quality is not that good, so it's very much for hobbyists or people that just want to play around with kind of funky geometries, but I believe it'll be only a matter of years before we have desktop printing that can build quite good quality parts. I mean, probably a range of plastics to start with that can be used from anything from consumer products to your things on your kitchen table, from knives and forks to lemon squeezers and whatever else you can imagine.
Thank you ever so much for your time, and enjoy your evening.
It's a pleasure.
I'm David Rowan, editor of Wired, and I've been chairing this conference, and it's a bit unfair to ask me what I think about it because I kind of programmed it. And you can't really have favorite children, can you? But there's some great ideas that I've been jotting down in my notebook as I've been frantically waving at speakers trying to get them to finish their bits on time. So Russell Davis in the last talk talked about, in this world where everybody has democratic access to making things, 3D printing or whatever, are we going to risk becoming, you know, the GeoCities of the physical thing? Do you remember when GeoCities launched in the early days of the web and everybody thought, oh, well, I can be a publisher and it looked naff? So I'm thinking, that's true. Just because we have the tools doesn't mean we have the skills to design something beautiful. So that's an idea that I'm going to take away. Chris Anderson's idea that what happened to atoms is happening to physical things in all sorts of exciting ways in the maker culture. That's something I've been thinking about quite a lot. It's going to take me a couple of years for it all to settle in, I think.
Can you sum up the event in three words? And again, this is incredibly difficult for you because you have spent months and months and months planning it.
The Wired event in three words. Curated esoteric genius.
Well, enjoy your success and your beer.
Thank you, Katie.
David Rowan there, enjoying a hard-earned beer. Ah, the man was tired. As were we all on that last day. Exhausting work. But yes, as we said, videos of all the talks are available on wired.co.uk for free. You can download them. They'll play on your iPod as well or on any device you want. So go and check them out.
I think you can go directly to the talks and all our write-ups from the conference, can't you?
You can. wired.co.uk/11. Yeah. And we will be doing Wired 2012 next year. So go and tell us if you want to come.
Start saving up.
Yeah. That's going to do it for the show this week. Liv, tell people how they can get in touch with some feedback.
Well, you can follow our tweety goodness on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. And you can also obviously message us there and give us some tweety badness if you like.
Yeah, or just send us links to pictures of animals doing silly things.
And Duncan, tell us about this enormous book of face we're on.
We are on a book of face. If you go to facebook.com/WiredUK and hit the like button, then you can see enormously, incredibly exciting things there.
And we've got an email address, of course, podcast@wired.co.uk if you want to send us some electronic post. This show has been enjoyed by our new intern, Dan Smith. Dan, shout hello.
Hello.
There he is. And I think on that wonderfully melodic note, thanks for that, Dan. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
She grabbed them in the corner between beers. That sounds a little bit predatory.
That's all right. That's basically what she did.